to read the Sunday edition of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. Our first article this morning headlined, Reynolds announces first steps to reopen Iowa while coronavirus deaths hit a record high. From Des Moines by Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau of the Courier. On a day when Iowa had its highest numbers yet of new coronavirus-related cases and deaths, Governor Kim Reynolds announced the first steps to reopen the state's myriad closed businesses and amenities. The state confirmed 521 new COVID-19 cases and 11 additional virus-related deaths Friday, including 3 in Blackhawk County and 1 in Bremer County. On Sunday, the state announced 648 positive cases for a total of 5,092 positive cases. It included one additional death for Blackhawk County. There are now a total of 112 deaths due to the virus. Also on Friday, Reynolds announced that starting Monday, hospitals and clinics may resume conducting elective surgeries and that farmers markets may operate, provided patrons practice safe social distancing measures. Both orders are effective statewide. In Waterloo, Mayor Quentin Hart announced Friday that the city's public golf courses would reopen, as well as the Pat Bowlesby Memorial Dog Park and the Burns Park Tennis Center. Quote, "This is our first step of many to reopening Iowa and getting life and business back to normal as soon as possible," Reynolds said during her daily briefing on the state's pandemic response. She said she plans to announce more steps on Monday. "It will be done in a responsible and safe manner, but we are at a place where it's time to start having that discussion." The record one-day number of new cases is partially due to increased testing efforts by the state. More than 2,700 tests were processed Thursday. Reynolds said that is much higher than the state had been testing on a daily basis. But Iowa also has experienced its two highest single-day death totals in the past week, 11 confirmed Friday and 10 confirmed on April 18th. Reynolds said that increased testing, in addition to expanded contact tracing and the rollout of the new Test Iowa program, is why she feels comfortable starting a gradual reopening of the state. She said the testing will help the state identify areas where the virus is less disruptive, which will allow for a gradual regional approach to reopening businesses and amenities. In addition, 3 area senior living facilities have announced that they have positive COVID-19 cases among employees and at least one resident. A new Aldea Lifescapes employee is being treated, as well as Ravenwood Specialty Care employees. 3 Western Home Communities employees have tested positive, and a resident has as well. CEO Chris Hansen said they believe the resident contracted the virus during an essential medical procedure outside of Western Home Communities. The resident is in isolation. Quote, "We believe this represents a low risk of exposure to employees because they've consistently worn a full complement of personal protective equipment while providing care," he said. The state public health department has divided the state into 6 regions and ranks the severity of the virus's prevalence in each region on a 1 to 12 scale, with 12 being the most severe. As of Friday, the Northeast, Southeast, and South Central regions all were rated at a 9, while the Northwest, Southwest, and North Central regions were rated no higher than a 6. As of Friday, nearly half, 46% of all confirmed cases were in 4 Eastern and Central Iowa counties, Polk, Blackhawk, Linn, and Johnson. Meantime, the bottom 87 counties combined to account for just 17% of all cases, including 15 counties that remained without a single recorded case. Woodbury remains the only county in the western half of the state with at least 100 confirmed cases. While there are some areas in our state where virus activity is still high, we have many more areas where it's manageable or even minimal. And this presents an opportunity to start to open Iowa back up in a phased and responsible manner, Reynolds said during the briefing at the State Emergency Operations Center at Camp Dodge in Johnston. Reynolds added, she is ready to begin reopening Iowa in part because the state has been able to avoid a rush on its health care system. According to state figures, there are 278 patients hospitalized, 104 in intensive care, and 60 on ventilators as of Friday. Meantime, the state has nearly 4,000 inpatient beds, more than 500 ICU beds, and nearly 700 ventilators available. The state continues its effort to acquire more protective equipment for healthcare workers, like face masks and shields and gowns. And Reynolds on Friday invited nurses to volunteer to help staff at long-term care facilities, which are being hit by COVID-19 outbreaks throughout the state. Todd Pritchard, a state lawmaker and leader of the Iowa House Democrats, issued a statement after Reynolds' briefing Friday saying the governor should make public the data and projections her administration is using to determine when and where it is safe to reopen Iowa businesses. Instead of sending mixed signals, the governor needs to provide clear leadership to bring Iowa out of this pandemic safely. The governor didn't provide the information necessary today to demonstrate to Iowans that it is safe to loosen restrictions that prevent the spread of the coronavirus, Pritchard said in a news release. We all want to reopen our economy and get life back to normal as quickly as possible. However, there is significant risk of more deaths, infections, and a prolonged economic downturn if restrictions are lifted too soon. In another article, Pandemic, the Latest Crisis to Strike Farmers, again by Aaron Murphy of the Des Moines Bureau. Iowa farmers were having a tough go of it well before the novel coronavirus made its way to the United States. Floods, droughts, international trade disputes, and federal agriculture policy battles all contributed to stunted crop and livestock prices, making it difficult for Iowa farmers to manage their bottom lines. Then the global pandemic made matters significantly worse. COVID-19, the disease the virus causes, has claimed over 50,000 lives in the United States and 112 in Iowa since it was discovered here March 8th. States have enacted drastic policies in an effort to slow its spread, while public health officials and experts credit those policies with saving lives. The policies also have dramatically altered the lives of every American and the way the nation's food supply chain operates. With schools, restaurants, and other businesses closed, demand for food is down, causing excess inventory and even lower prices. People increasingly shopping and sometimes hoarding at grocery stores have not made up the gap. Quote, this is brand new for us because the demand was always hit there, said Jay Shanbaker, a third-generation dairyman whose Shanbaker Acres family farm is near Atkins in Benton County. Now we have a demand problem. The virus could cost Iowa's agricultural economy more than $6 billion, according to a study from Iowa State University's Center for Agricultural and Rural Development. Robert LaRue, president of the National Farmers Union, said the situation facing family farms and rural communities is, quote, extraordinary. Spring is normally a very optimistic time, a hopeful time for farmers as they prepare the fields to get crops out there. But this is no ordinary spring, as we know, LaRue said recently during an online news conference hosted by Iowa-based Focus on Rural America, a liberal-leaning ag policy group. And this is coming on the heels of some really tough past years. Farmers are financially stretched to the brink across all commodities and livestock. And the recent disruptions and market changes are just sending those operations in more dire straits at this time. The Iowa State University study said if social distancing policies remain through the rest of the year, the state's ethanol and hog industries both stand to experience more than $2 billion in losses. The study projects the corn industry would incur $788 million in losses, cattle $658 million, and soybeans $213 million. Chad Hart, an agriculture economist at ISU and one of the co-authors on the economic impact study, said the state's ag sectors are experiencing revenue losses between 15% and 50%. The depth of the dip is quite dramatic, Hart said on the latest episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. We're seeing some of the largest cuts in our meat industry and our energy sector, but all phases of our agricultural economy are feeling the effects of COVID-19. Because of reduced demand, farmers have been forced to dispose of myriad products. In some places in the nation, dairy farmers are dumping milk, poultry farmers are dumping eggs, and pork producers are facing difficult decisions over what to do with excess hogs. It's a challenging time in agriculture, especially for dairy, egg, and livestock producers and our renewable fuels industry, Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig said recently during a telephone town hall with Iowa farmers, hosted by U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. Quote, "Make no mistake, this pandemic impacts all of us. The supply chain disruptions are threatening our livelihood, and some farmers we've been hearing about have been forced to dispose of some of the products that they worked so incredibly hard to produce," unquote. The challenges facing hog farmers have been especially pronounced over the past 2 weeks as coronavirus outbreaks have hit pork processing plants in Waterloo, Columbus Junction, Perry, and also just across the state's borders in Illinois and South Dakota. Many of the plants shut down temporarily to make them safer for workers, and when they reopen, some are operating at less than normal capacity, Governor Kim Reynolds has said. That slowdown has left hog farmers with too many hogs. Reynolds said last week that some farmers have become faced with having to decide whether to euthanize some of their hogs. Iowa's pork industry is in dire straits, Ernst said in a statement, adding that she has pressed the Federal Ag Department to support hurting pork farmers. With a system designed for just-in-time delivery, this important sector of our state's economy has been turned on its head due to meat processing plant closures across Iowa and the Midwest. Our producers are now facing difficult and devastating decisions that can lead them to literally throwing out their livelihoods. With Americans practicing social distancing and not traveling as much, gas sales and prices have plummeted, damaging Iowa's ethanol industry. Hart said he is aware of at least 9 ethanol plants in Iowa that have shut down, and many more have slowed their production. Along with that, the ethanol industry is facing the sort of implosion of the oil market, Hart said. When you think of oil prices going negative earlier this month, the idea is there are all sorts of economic pressures that are also pushing down on the ethanol sector here. So we're seeing losses not only in terms of production, but in pricing and concerns about long-term demand for the product. School and restaurant closures have devastated milk demand, Tom Vilsack said during the Focus on Rural America news conference. Vilsack is president and chief executive of the U.S. Dairy Export Council and is a former Iowa governor and U.S. Agriculture Secretary. Vilsack said, closing schools and restaurants and limiting fast food restaurants to drive-through and carry-out has reduced demand for dairy by roughly half. Farmers are dumping as many as 3.7 million gallons of milk each day, according to an estimate from the Dairy Farmers of America, a national marketing co-op. Schanbacher Acres sells to a dairy cooperative that in turn supplies manufacturers that make, for instance, cheese and butter. "We have not been asked to dump milk, but I think every farmer in the co-op has had the conversation with their field representative," Schanbacher said. "The lack of demand could cause dairy farmers like him," he said, "to take a closer look at their herds and consider selling some of the less profitable cows for beef." Advocates and elected officials continue to press the federal government for assistance, while others have begun to question whether the pandemic has shown that the structure of the nation's food supply needs an overhaul. On the telephone town hall with Iowa farmers, meantime, NEG tried to strike a hopeful tone. "We know that agriculture is no stranger to adversity and managing through risk, but by working together, that will help our farmers in need, and we'll intend to come out of this stronger on the other side," he said. Our next article, by Amy Rivers from The Courier, headlined, "Embark, Providing Multilingual Coronavirus Information, Food Delivery," from Waterloo. As the state of Iowa started recording its first cases of coronavirus in early March, the governor started daily briefings updating residents of the growing infection and death rates, and news organizations have been covering the unfolding pandemic within Iowa's borders in earnest. But nearly all of that coverage and information has been in English, Iowa's official language. That meant refugees who don't speak English as a first language were left in the dark about coronavirus's impact. It's so hard for them to obtain good, credible information because of the language barrier, said Aaron Kim Cho, communications consultant at Embark, a nonprofit helping Burmese residents and other refugees based in Des Moines. They were getting information kind of as a rumor or word of mouth. One of those rumors? That the Burmese, who have survived the horrors of living through Myanmar's civil war as well as refugee camps in Thailand, would not contract the highly contagious virus. Kim Cho described the thinking as, "We've gone through so much in the past that we will be immune to this." "We wanted to clarify that with credible sources," she said. To aid in that effort, the organization started Embark Daily News, which translates the latest news and coronavirus information that is then read each day in Burmese, English, French, Hakka Shin, Karen, Karini, Karundi, Kunama, Lingala, Mizochin, and Swahili, the languages of the refugees the organization serves in both Des Moines and Waterloo. The videos are a few minutes long and briefly cover a few topics, Monday through Thursday. This past Thursday, that included some enclosures of meatpacking plants, drive-through coronavirus testing sites, and President Donald Trump's latest immigration order. What we've been finding is that when we post it on YouTube, not only are we getting listeners from local cities, but a lot of people from throughout the country, Kim Cho said. "It's really great, and that kind of shows there is this need for better communications, good information, and credible sources that's not happening for these community members." At the same time, Embark also rolled out a crisis helpline, staffed Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and available in the same languages as the daily news. That helpline helps clients access food assistance, set up medical appointments, book an interpreter, apply for unemployment benefits, and other emergency needs. We are anticipating more calls about unemployment and assistance, Kim Cho said. Embark partners with the Northeast Iowa Food Bank do direct deliveries to around 30 families per week, said Carr May, an Embark AmeriCorps member who coordinates those deliveries. The families we serve are uncomfortable going out of their houses, May said. Since we started it, the number has increased. I'm expecting more families to reach out. We've also set up a youth navigator support group for middle and high school students, said Grafe Kalala, who leads Waterloo's youth group. The group, who meets virtually to adhere to social distancing mandates, has attracted several students through word of mouth. We help students with their emotional and mental stability throughout this crisis period, Kalala said, noting the activities included music and fitness. Embark officials said they could use more delivery drivers, particularly as the need increases, and they're also hoping for homemade cloth masks they can include in care packages to families. Those with video editing and graphic design skills were also asked to contact Embark for help with their daily videos. Everything helps at this point, said Kim Cho. Those interested in volunteering are asked to email COVID-19@embarkiowa.org or call 515-207-5168 after 5 p.m. Well, here's something that actually doesn't talk about the virus. Headlined, 10 Gold Star Teachers Announced by McElroy Trust, by Kristen Guess, the Waterloo Courier Bureau. 10 Blackhawk County teachers have been named 2020 Gold Star Award winners. The Gold Star Award for Outstanding Teacher is co-sponsored by the R.J. McElroy Trust and KWWL Television. McElroy Trust received 1,113 nominations for 500 teachers in the county this year. Teachers were nominated by students, parents, community members, and colleagues. The 10 award winners represent the hundreds of teachers who rise above everyday standards to help students achieve their fullest potential. In addition to a $1,000 honorarium, the McElroy Trust will also award each Gold Star teacher $500 to improve his or her classroom. The program honoring this year's Gold Star teachers will be at 7 p.m. September 29th in the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center on the University of Northern Iowa campus. This is the 32nd year of the event. The winners are Alexander Conyers, 9th through 12th grade science at West High School; Ashley Hager, 2nd grade, Cunningham Elementary; Denise Aldrichs, 5th grade, Aldrich Elementary; Gail Farber, English Language Development Specialist at Waterloo Lincoln Elementary; Nicole Davis, 5th through 12th grade band at Hudson Community Schools; Rebecca Keeling, 6th grade science and math at Blessed Maria Assuncia Pelota Middle School; Rebecca Linz, counselor at Pete Junior High; Ryan Christopher, 4th grade, Highland Elementary; Ryan Lehman, 2nd grade, Lowell Elementary; and Sherry Parker, 2nd grade, at Dysart Geneseo Elementary. One person dies in house fire in Charles City. A person has died in a Saturday house fire in Charles City. The fire was reported about 2:20 a.m. Saturday at 715 8th Avenue, Charles City. Fire officials said as they arrived, smoke was seen coming from the home's roof and attic area. After entry, firefighters found that the fire had occurred solely in the kitchen area of the home. Charles City Fire Department firefighters found heavy smoke throughout the home and that the fire was starved for oxygen to spread any further from the kitchen. Due to the lack of oxygen, the fire had mostly self-extinguished. While extinguishing the remains of the smoldering fire in the kitchen, firefighters did a search of the home, discovering a person in the home who was deceased. 13 CCFD firefighters responded to the fire with two engines, an aerial, and a command vehicle. There was only one occupant in the home at the time of the fire, and no firefighter injuries were reported. A name has not been released. According to Floyd County Assessor Online Records, the home is owned by Kathy Cruz and Gary Schmidt. Investigation of the cause and origin of the fire, conducted by the CCFD investigators, concluded that the fire started in the kitchen, likely due to cooking materials overheating. There was major fire damage to the kitchen, no water damage, and heavy smoke damage to the rest of the house. Smoke alarms were present and sounding when the CCFD arrived. Fire officials also said another house fire Wednesday night at 200 Kelly Street in Charles City, where a firefighter was injured. There were no occupants of the home inside when the firefighters arrived, and the fire was quickly extinguished. One firefighter sustained a minor injury and refused treatment at the scene. No other injuries were reported at the scene of the fire. The home is owned by Michael Vanderschleis, according to the Floyd County Assessor's GIS website. Waterloo to consider new eightplex building north of Home Park Boulevard. By Amy Rivers from the Courier from Waterloo. The city will consider whether to approve $40,000 in incentives for a new eightplex multifamily building in the area of Highway 63 and Home Park Boulevard at their regular Monday meeting. The Waterloo City Council will consider approving a development agreement with Net Worth Investments of Cedar Falls, which plans to construct an eightplex directly north of 1150 Home Park Boulevard. The estimated value of the building will be $750,000 upon completion, according to documents. Because it is an infill development, the agreement would also allow for the developer, Andrea McHugh, to receive a $5,000 per unit grant from the city for a total of $40,000 once each unit receives a certificate of occupancy after completion. However, because McHugh is married to Waterloo Police Officer Matthew McHugh, per Iowa code, she is not able to receive more than $6,000 per year in incentives. The agreement, therefore, is drafted so that she would receive no more than $6,000 per year for 6 years, and then $40,000 in the seventh year, according to Noel Anderson, the city's Community Planning and Development Director. The City Council will meet in its regular session at 5:30 p.m. Monday. This is a reminder. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, April 6, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the Metro Deaths column from Waterloo, Sherry L. Taylor Huynh, that's spelled H-U-Y-N-H. I'll pronounce it Huynh for now. 1961 to 2020 from Waterloo. Sherry Lynn Taylor Huynh, 58, of Waterloo, died Saturday, April 25th, at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. She was born October 15, 1961, in California, daughter of Jean and Donna Lee Bulmer Taylor. She was a member of Heartland Vineyard Church in Waterloo. Survivors are a son, Allen with wife Thaisa Huynh of New Jersey, a brother Gene Taylor of Faribault, Minnesota, a sister Debbie Craig Sebakow of Rhinebeck, and several grandchildren and nieces and nephews. Preceded in death by her parents, a brother Robert Taylor, and a sister Pam Taylor. A small private service will be held for now. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Perriton Wood Chapel of Memories, an Overton family service from Waterloo, is assisting the families. Memorials to Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences at www.perritonwood.com. She loved her grandchildren and going shopping. From Waterloo, Susan M. Manifold, 1953-2020, Waterloo. Susan M. Manifold, 66, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, April 21, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. She was born December 30, 1953, in Waterloo, daughter of John and Doris Harms Cavalier. She married Donovan D. Manifold on January 24, 1971, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. He died December 16, 2009. She attended Hawkeye and Ellsworth Community Colleges, earning a nursing degree. She was employed with Mercy One and then Presbyterian Village in Ackley. She was a member of First Reformed Church in Applington and Grace Reformed Church in Waterloo. Survivors include two sons, Matthew with Ann Manifold of Solon, and John with Sylvia Manifold of Bad Kissington, Germany. Eight grandchildren, Jared Madison Manifold, Lucas, Emily, Jack, Haley, Sarah, and Casey Manifold. A sister, Julie, and with Tom DeGroote of Waterloo, and a brother-in-law, Glenn Everts of Dumont. She is preceded in death by a son, Russell Manifold, and a sister, Teresa Everts. Private services will be held for the immediate family with interment in Pleasant View Cemetery in Applington. Richardson Funeral Service, Cedar Falls, is assisting the family. Memorials to Grace Reformed Church in Waterloo. Condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. From Cedar Falls, Mary J. O'Brien, 1926-2020. Mary Johanna O'Brien, 93, of Cedar Falls, died Friday, April 24, at New Aldea Lifescapes. She was born December 7, 1926, in Ridgeway, daughter of Leo and Marie Novak Donovan. She was a graduate of OLVA Academy in Waterloo. She married Richard O'Brien on January 6, 1950, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Waterloo. He died December 17, 2001. She worked at Rath Packing Company, 3M Company, and Washington County, Minnesota School District. She was a member of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Waterloo. Survivors include a son, Stephen, with Marcia O'Brien of Waterloo, two daughters, Helen with Doug Archibald of Cottage Grove, Minnesota, and Joan with Jim Siebers of Madison, Wisconsin. Six great-grandchildren, a sister, Leora Andorf of Cedar Falls, and a brother, Pat, with Mary Donovan of Ridgeway, Iowa, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Richard, a son, Tom O'Brien, two sisters, Virginia McMahon and Rita Barsness, a brother, Dennis Donovan. Due to COVID-19 gathering restrictions, a memorial service will be held at a later date. Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, 3146 Kimball Avenue, Waterloo, Iowa, is in charge of arrangements. Memorials to the family, where a memorial fund will be established at a later date. Cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. We are all so grateful to have had this generous, loving, kind, sassy, funny mom, grandma, aunt, friend in our lives. May she live in our happy memories. From Cedar Falls, Holly R. Clark, 1946 to 2020. Holly R. Clark, 73, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, April 22, from complications of lung cancer and COPD. He was born December 27, 1946, in Del Rio, Texas. He lived most of his life in the Cedar Rapids and Center Point area. Holly graduated from Washington High School and worked in the Cedar Rapids area as a machinist for 40 years after serving 4 years in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War. Survivors include his wife, Cheryl, a daughter, Julie, with Eric Stein of Lake Mills, a son, Chad Clark, with Julie Unland of Cedar Falls, and 4 grandchildren. He's preceded in death by his parents, Art and Wilma Clark. Per his request, there will be no visitation or public services. Memorials can go to Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Holly enjoyed traveling, fishing, NASCAR, playing cards, and spending time with his family. From Cedar Falls, Patricia M., known as Patsy Minkle, 1929 to 2020. Patricia M. Patsy Minkle, 91, of New Aldea Lifescapes, Cedar Falls, died Thursday, April 23, at Unity Point Health, Allen Hospital, Waterloo. She was born February 3, 1929, in Lake Andes, South Dakota, daughter of Thorald, or T.C., and May G. Austin Parker, and graduated from Harlington High School in Harlington, Texas. Patsy married James R. Minkle on October 11, 1947, in Westlake, Texas. He died September 2, 1984. She was a full-time homemaker. Survivors include her sons, Michael with Robin of Phoenix, Arizona, and Stephen with Betsy of Cedar Falls. 6 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, and a sister-in-law, Mary Parker of Lakewood, California. She's preceded in death by her husband, James, and a brother, Simeon Ralph Parker. Services, family graveside services, will be held at a later date, with an interment at Garden of Memories Cemetery, Waterloo. Arrangements by Locke Funeral Home, Waterloo. Memorials to Paralyzed Veterans of America, www.pva.org. Cards received at the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at www.lockfuneralhome.com. She enjoyed camping, traveling, bird watching, spending time with her family, especially the grandchildren. She was a member of Great Books Society. Patsy liked socializing at the Nazareth Lutheran Church, Thursday's senior meals. From Waterloo, Regina M. Theory, 1957 to 2020. Regina Marie Theory, 62, of Waterloo, died Monday, April 20, at Mercy One Medical, Waterloo. She was born May 2, 1957, in Waterloo, daughter of Delbert and Beatrice Moore Phillips. She married Kenneth Theory on May 7, 1977, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup. Regina was employed as a registrar for the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Survivors include her husband, her mother of Jessup, two daughters, Sarah with Paul Warren Lentfer of Mechanicsville, and Lisa with John Versluis of Geneseo, Illinois. Five grandchildren, three brothers, and three sisters. She was preceded in death by her father. Due to the pandemic, a private family service will take place at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, with burial in Santa Maria Cemetery, both in Gilbertville. A memorial mass will take place at a later date. Hackerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street is in charge of arrangements. Send memorials to the Bosco System or the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital in Iowa City. Online condolences at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Regina was an excellent quilter, baker, crafter, and most importantly, giver of self. She dearly loved teaching her skills to her grandchildren. From Cedar Falls, Kathleen M. Gersh, 1921 to 2020. Kathleen M. Gersh, 99, of New Aldea Lifescapes, Brill Assisted Living, Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, April 22. She was born April 13, 1921, in Waterloo, daughter of Dr. Joseph and Clara Jackman Murphy. She married Dr. William J. Gersh on June 19, 1943, in Decatur, Illinois. He died January 24, 2002. Kathleen received her teaching degree from Iowa State Teachers College and taught elementary school before raising her family. Survivors include her five sons, Dr. William J. Jr. with Kathy of Salem, Oregon, Michael with Janice of Cedar Falls, Martin with Lori of Sarasota, Florida, Christopher with Hiromi of Aquino, Japan, and John with Betty of Portland, Oregon. A daughter, Mary Jane Gersh of Portland, Oregon, 11 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband and two sons, Dr. Timothy Gersh and Dr. James Gersh. A private family funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April 30, at St. Edward's Catholic Church. Due to the pandemic, you're invited to join online with the family to pray for Kathleen through St. Edward's YouTube channel at www.sted.org. Hagerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. Memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. From Cedar Falls, Dr. Daniel J. Murphy, 1944 to 2020. Daniel John Murphy, 75, formerly of Cedar Falls, died of a heart attack on April 14, 2020, in Dili, East Timor. He was born September 23, 1944, in Alton. He received his doctorate in medicine from the University of Iowa Medical School in 1970. Then he began a humanitarian medical odyssey that filled the rest of his days. He served as a physician at the United Farm Workers Health Clinic in Delano, California. He trained barefoot doctors in the mountains of Mozambique and ended his career at a clinic he created in Dili, East Timor. Dan was the runner-up in the annual The One Rotary Award, a worldwide competition for humanitarian work. He was a recipient of the Distinguished Alumnus Award from the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine, as well as the Sergio Vieira de Mello Award for his work in Timor-Leste. In 2009, he was presented the Medal of Merit, the country's highest honor, by former President and Nobel Laureate José Ramos Horta. Survivors include two sons, Liam and Connor, both of Decorah, a grandson, Jack, four siblings, Mary Fegebank of Orlando, Florida, Mike Murphy of Pullman, Washington, Ann O'Fallon of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Maureen Murphy of Cedar Falls, many nieces, nephews, and countless cousins. Memorials to East Timor Hearts Fund, https://easttimorheartsfund.org.au, or sent to Maureen Murphy, 315 Olive Street, Cedar Falls, 50613. The extraordinary circumstances of our time prevent gathering together. His family hopes that the months ahead will allow for a celebration of his life, well lived. Over his 20 years in Dili, Dan never charged a patient for their care and never took a salary. Daniel was a man of passion and justice. From Hudson, Vonda Susie Young, 1955 to 2020. Vonda Susie Young, 65, of Hudson, died at home on Saturday, April 25. She was born March 25, 1955, in Henderson, Kentucky, to Woodring and Vonda Fryer. She attended Henderson High School and completed her degree as an electronic technician. She attended St. Timothy Lutheran Church. Due to the pandemic, no services will be held at this time. However, there will be a celebration of her life planned for a future date. Memorials in lieu of flowers to PETPEA, that's Pet Pals, with a period between each letter, at www.petpalscedarvalley.org, Box 373, Cedar Falls, Iowa, or the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, www.pancan.org. Online condolences at www.iowacremation.com. Through the years, she was a very hard worker, but especially enjoyed helping and caring for others. She loved camping with her family and friends, and enjoyed traveling and visiting new places. From Waverly, Shirley Ann Crawford, 1936 to 2020. It's actually put in here 1936 to 3030. I don't think that'll work. From Waverly, Shirley Ann Crawford, 83, of Waverly, died Friday, April 24, at her son's home in Waverly following a lengthy illness. She was born December 16, 1936, in Waterloo, daughter of Lawrence and Norma Bozen Bance. She graduated from Waverly High School in 1955. On August 7, 1955, she married Calvin Crawford at Faith United Methodist Church in Waverly. She was employed with L.F. Bance Plumbing and Heating from 1951 to 1961, at Blackhawk Publishing from 1979 to 1983, and Cuna Life Insurance from 1993 until her retirement in 1995. Calvin died April 21, 1994. Shirley was a member of Heritage United Methodist Church in Waverly. Due to the pandemic, a memorial service to celebrate Shirley's life will be held at a later date. Private family services will be held at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly, with burial in Harlington Cemetery, Waverly. Memorials to Heritage United Methodist Church or the family. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. She was affectionately known as the Card Lady, sending birthday, anniversary, and other cards to countless people over the years. She enjoyed riding motorcycles and making folks happy. Above all, the time spent with her friends and family were most important to her. From Waverly, Lori M. Hunnemiller, 1959 to 2020. Lori M. Hunnemiller, 60 of Waverly, died unexpectedly Thursday, April 23rd at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center in Waterloo. She was born October 16, 1959 in Muscatine, daughter of Carrie and Grace Kubitschek Young. She graduated from Waverly Shell Rock High School in 1977. On July 14, 1979, Lori married Doug Hunnemiller at Trinity United Methodist Church in Waverly. Lori worked at Mervyn's as an accountant and at Tarek's Crane in Waverly until 1992. Lori then became a stay-at-home wife and mom due to health issues. Due to the pandemic, the family will not have a public service at this time. Private visitation and funeral will be held at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly, with burial in Harlington Cemetery, Waverly. Memorials to the family can be sent to Kaiser Corson Funeral Home, attention Lori Hunnemiller, Box 215, Waverly, Iowa. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. Lori's greatest love in life was memories made with her husband, children, and grandchildren. She also enjoyed flowers and spending time with her puppies. From Allison, Nola R. Rennington, 1956 to 2020. Nola Ray Redding, 63, of Allison, died Wednesday, April 22, at Mayo Clinic Hospital, St. Mary's Campus, in Rochester, Minnesota. She was born December 11, 1956, in Waterloo, to Darrell and Lonnie Dams Chevalier. Nola married Harold Redding on June 9, 1973, in Hudson. Nola trained German Shepherds for many years. Private family services will be held with burial at Oak Hill Cemetery in Bristol. Seatsum of Vogel Funeral Home in Allison is assisting Nola's family. Memorials to the family at P.O. Box 403, Hampton, Iowa, 50441. She enjoyed playing cards with her grandchildren and watching the Boston Celtics. She loved horseback riding and had a passion for horses her entire life. Nola's three main loves and most important things to her were God, family, and horses, her dogs being a close third. From Independence, Marla M. Dinnebier, 1958 to 2020. Marla Maxine Dinnebier, 61, of rural Independence, died Thursday, April 23, at Ravenwood Specialty Care in Waterloo. She was born November 21, 1958, in Waterloo, daughter of Robert Leroy Nelson and Mary Edna Gardner Nelson. She graduated from West High School in Waterloo in 1976. On March 4, 1978, she married Ralph W. or Bill Dinnebier at the American Lutheran Church in Jessup. He died April 7, 2013. Marla was a homemaker, but also had worked at Valley Services. Due to the pandemic, private services will be held Monday with burial in Old Barclay Cemetery, rural Jessup. Memorials to the family by mailing them to White Funeral Home in Jessup. Online condolences at www.whitemounthope.com. She enjoyed camping and spending time with her family and friends. From Grundy Center, James Jim Heidemann, 1940 to 2020. James Jim William Ernest Heidemann, 80, of Grundy Center, died at his daughter's home in Grundy Center on April 22 while under the care of Cedar Valley Hospice. He was born March 27, 1940, in Waterloo, son of Henry and Clara Sommerfeldt Heidemann. He married Audrey Melinda Louise Delfs on November 22, 1959, at American Lutheran Church in Grundy Center. He worked at Case IH and Swift Packing before becoming a trucker for Gray Transportation. He also helped many area farmers in the fields, retiring in 2010. Sir, due to the pandemic, a private visitation and interment at Maple Hill Cemetery will be held. They will hold a gathering in the future. Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Anglicase Chapel, is assisting the families. Memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.abelsfuneralhomes.com. Jim enjoyed fishing, racing, country music, and ice-cold beer, watching professional wrestling, and was an avid Green Bay Packers fan. He loved spending his time outdoors and camping. His best time was spent with his family and friends. Jim was a member of American Lutheran Church in Grundy Center. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, April 6, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening today.